Either in her face or growling on the phone as another deal teetered on the brink. He repeatedly badgered the nurses and orderlies to bring him more coffee. And when the coffee didn't materialize, he stomped down to the cafeteria, where the food looked dreadful. The doctors made their rounds, each glaring at him as he seemed ready for any confrontation. They were careful not to provoke. For Lacey, though, his energy was infectious, even stimulating. He amused her, though she was still afraid to laugh. Once, when she awoke, he was standing next to her bed, wiping tears from his cheeks. At 6, Nurse Ratchet appeared and said her shift would be ending. She asked Gunther about his plans, and he replied, rather sternly, "I'm not leaving. This sofa is here for a reason. And for what you folks charge, you could certainly provide something more comfortable than this flimsy fold-out. I mean, hell, an army cot would be more comfortable."
"I'll pass that along," she said. "See you in the morning, Lacey."
"What a bitch," Gunther mumbled, just loud enough for her to hear as she closed the door. For dinner, Gunther fed her ice cream and jello while he ate nothing. They watched Friends reruns until she was exhausted. As she dozed off, he was back in his nest, hammering out emails with no sign of slowing down. Throughout the night, the nurses eased in and out. At first, Gunther bitched about the noise they made, but soon settled down when a cute one he fancied slipped him a Xanax. By midnight, he was snoring, the flimsy fold-out sofa notwithstanding. Around 5 Friday morning, Lacey began to fidget and moan. She was asleep and dreaming, and the dreams were not pleasant. Gunther patted her arm, whispered that everything was going to be fine, that she would be home in no time. She awoke with a jolt and breathed heavily.
"What is it?"
he asked.
"Some water," she said,
and he lifted a straw to her mouth. She took a long sip, and he wiped her mouth.
"I saw it, Gunther. I saw the truck just before we hit. Hugo screamed, and I looked ahead, and there were bright lights right in front of us. Then everything went black."
"Atta girl. Do you remember a sound? Maybe the collision, maybe the explosion of the airbag in your face?"
"Maybe. I'm not sure."
"Did you see the other driver?"
"No. Nothing but lights. Really bright. It happened so fast, Gunther. I had no time to react."
"Of course you didn't. It wasn't your fault. Truck crossed the center line."
"It did. Yes, it did."
She closed her eyes again, and a few seconds passed before he realized she was crying.
"It's okay, sis. It's okay."
"Hugo's not really dead, is he, Gunther?"
"Yes, Lacey. You need to accept it and believe it and stop asking if it's really true. Hugo is dead."
She cried, and there was nothing he could do. He ached for her as she shivered and struggled and grieved for her friend. Finally, mercifully, she went back to sleep. Chapter 16. After the early morning wave of doctors, nurses, and orderlies, things settled down somewhat, and Gunther worked on his deals. Lacey was improving by the hour. The swelling in her face was easing, though her bruises were changing into various shades of blue. Around 9 o'clock, Michael Geismar arrived and was startled to see such an elaborate makeshift office in Lacey's room. She was awake and sipping lukewarm coffee through a straw. Gunther, unshaven, in his socks and with his shirt tail to his knees, introduced himself as her brother and was immediately suspicious of this guy in a dark suit. Lacey said, "Relax, he's my boss." And Gunther stood down. He and Michael shook hands tentatively across the bed and all was peaceful. Michael asked, "Do you feel like talking?"
"I guess," she said.
Lyman Gritt is the constable for the reservation, and he wants to stop by and ask some questions. Probably a good idea if we cover things first.
Okay.
Michael looked at Gunther, who showed no signs of even thinking about leaving the room. Michael said to him, "This is quite confidential. It deals with one of our investigations." With no hesitation, Gunther said,
"I'm not budging. She's my sister and she needs my advice. I need to know everything and I get the concept of confidentiality. Right, Lacey?"
Lacey had no choice but to say, "He can stay." Michael was in no mood for a fight. Plus, Gunther had a glow in his eyes that was clear evidence of a short fuse. "What the hell?" Michael said.
"No word from Myers. I called the three numbers in your file several times and got nothing but ringing on the other end. Guess he doesn't do voicemail."
"I doubt if they could track him, Michael."
"Who's Myers?" Gunther asked.
"I'll tell you later," Lacey said.
"Or not," Michael said. Back to Monday night. "What can you tell me about the meeting with the informant?"
Lacey closed her eyes and took a deep breath, one that made her grimace. Slowly, she said,
"Not much, Michael. Not much. We went to the casino. We waited in the parking lot. Then we drove down a dark road and stopped at a small building."
She paused for a long time and seemed to be napping. Michael asked,
"Did you meet with the informant?"
She shook her head. "Nothing, Michael. I don't remember."
"Did Hugo talk to the guy on his cell phone?"
"I think so. Yes, he had to. The guy told us where to drive and meet him. Yes, I remember that."
"What about the collision itself? Anything leading up to it? The other vehicle?"
She closed her eyes again as if her memory might work better in the dark. After a gap, Gunther said,
"Early this morning, she was having a nightmare. She woke up and said she could see the headlights. Said she remembers Hugo screaming. And before she could react, the truck was right there. She remembers it was a truck. She does not remember the impact or the noise or anything else. Nothing about the rescue, the ambulance, the medevac, the emergency room. Nothing."
One of Gunther's muted cell phones erupted in vibration. A call so urgent that the device tried to bounce across the purloined feeding table in his half of the room. He glared at it and fought the temptation, the way a drunk in recovery stares at a cold beer. He let it pass. Michael nodded toward the door, and the two stepped into the hallway. He asked,
"How much have you talked to her doctors?"
"Not much. I don't think they like me."
"What a surprise."
"Well, they tell me her memory will slowly come back. The best way to help is to stimulate her brain, primarily by talking. Make her talk. Make her laugh. Make her listen. As soon as possible, get her some magazines and see if she'll read. She loves old movies, so watch them with her. Less sleep and more noise is what she needs."
Gunther hung on every word, thrilled to be taking charge of things.
"Got it. Let's chat with her doctors and try to keep the constable away from her for as long as possible. He wants to know what she and Hugo were doing on his land. And frankly, we don't want him to know. It's strictly confidential."
"Got that, Michael, but I want to know the details of the wreck. Everything. Tell me what you know so far. I smell a rat."
"With good reason. Find your shoes and let's get some coffee."
After lunch on Friday, as Gunther stalked the halls with his phone and fought desperately to salvage one crumbling deal after another, Lacey typed an email.
Dear Verna, Lacey here, on my brother's iPad. I'm still in the hospital and finally have enough strength and clarity to check in. I don't know where to start or what to say. I cannot believe this has happened. It is so surreal. I close my eyes and tell myself I'm not here, Hugo is fine, and when I wake up, all will be well. But then I wake up and realize that this tragedy is real, that he has been taken, that you and the kids are suffering a loss that cannot be described. I am so sorry, not only for the loss, but also for my role in it. I don't remember what happened, except that I was driving and Hugo was my passenger. That's not important now, though I'll carry it to my grave. I so wish I could see you right now and hug you and the kids. I love you all and can't wait to see you. I'm so sorry I'll miss the service tomorrow. I'm crying just thinking about it. I'm crying a lot, but not nearly as much as you. My heart breaks for you and the kids, Verna. You are in my thoughts and prayers. Love, Lacey.
24 hours later, the email had not been answered. The funeral service for Hugo Hatch began at 2 p.m. on Saturday, at a suburban megachurch with a soaring modern sanctuary that seated almost 2,000. Hugo and Verna had joined Gateway Tabernacle years earlier and were semi-active members. The congregation was virtually all African American, and many of their family members and most of their friends also attended. As 2 p.m. approached, the crowd settled in somberly as everyone braced for the waves of emotion to come. There were a few empty seats, but not many. First up was a slideshow on a massive screen above the pulpit. As a mournful spiritual was piped in from the sound system, one photo after another of Hugo came across, each a painful reminder that he had indeed been taken much too soon. Cute little Hugo as a toddler. Hugo gap-toothed in grade school. Hugo in all manner of football shots. Hugo on his wedding day. Hugo playing with his kids. There were dozens of photos, and they provoked a lot of tears. And as the service continued, there would be a lot of everything. Finally, after a gut-wrenching half-hour, the screen disappeared as the choir loft filled with 100 singers in beautiful burgundy robes. Their mini-concert swung haphazardly from low, mournful dirges to rowdy, foot-stomping, old-time gospel favorites, to which the entire congregation sang along. There were a few white faces in the crowd. Michael and his wife had a front-row seat in the long, sweeping balcony. As he glanced around, he saw others from BJC. He noted that most white folks were in the balcony, as if trying to keep some distance from the rowdiness below. Michael, a child of the 1960s and Jim Crow, saw the irony of the blacks in the best seats while the whites seemed banished to the balcony. After an hour of warm-ups, the Reverend took charge and spoke for 15 minutes, his opening. A gifted and seasoned orator with a powerful baritone, he offered comfort to the loved ones while making the crowd cry even harder. The first eulogy was from Hugo's older brother, who told funny stories from their childhood but broke down halfway through. The second eulogy was from his high school football coach, a tough, crusty old white guy who barely uttered 3 sentences before choking up and crying like a baby. The third eulogy was from a teammate at Florida State. The fourth was from a law school professor. Then a soprano gave a magnificent rendition of How Great Thou Art, and when she finished, there was not a dry eye to be found, including her own. Verna, in the center of the front row, somehow managed to hold things together. She was surrounded by family and had the two older kids next to her. An aunt was keeping Pippin and the toddler. Even as others wailed and collapsed, Verna just stared at the casket, 10 feet away, and wiped her eyes without making a sound. Upon the advice of a doctor friend, and against tradition, she had decided to close the casket. A large, handsome photo of her husband stood next to it on a tripod. As the service ground on, Michael couldn't help but glance at his watch. He was a devout Presbyterian, and in his church, sermons were strictly limited to 20 minutes, weddings to 30, and if a funeral inched past 45 minutes, somebody would catch an earful. But the clock did not matter on this day at the Gateway Tabernacle. This was the last song and dance for Hugo Hatch, and it would be a glorious send-off. The 5th eulogy was given by a cousin who'd served time for drugs and was now clean and working, thanks to Hugo. It was all quite moving, but 2 hours in, Michael was itching to leave. He was also relieved to be sitting comfortably in a padded chair and not worrying about standing down there behind the pulpit. The Hatch family had initially asked if he would consider saying a few words at the funeral, but the offer was quickly withdrawn by Verna. Michael was aware of some initial grumblings on her part. Hugo's death, whether accident or something else, could probably have been prevented if his boss hadn't sent him into such a dangerous situation. Hugo's older brother had called twice, curious about the trip to the reservation that late at night. The family was getting over the shock and asking questions, and Michael smelled trouble. The 6th and last eulogy was from Roderick, Hugo and Verna's oldest child. He wrote a 3-page tribute to his father, and it was read by the Reverend. Even Michael Geismar, a cold-blooded Presbyterian, finally succumbed to his emotions. The Reverend wrapped things up with a lengthy benediction, and as the choir hummed and swayed, the pallbearers rolled Hugo down the aisle. Verna was close behind, holding a child with each hand, her jaw tight with determination, her head held high, her cheeks dripping with tears. She was followed by a pack of family members, few of whom were making any effort at restraint. The mourners left the building and scattered into the parking lots. Most would reassemble in half an hour at the cemetery for another memorial that would be too long and too gut-wrenching. Through it all, not one harsh word was thrown at the person responsible for Hugo's death. Of course, no one knew his name. A drunk driver in a stolen truck who got away on foot was the accepted version. And so, with no one to blame, the Reverend and the speakers took the high ground. When Hugo Hatch was lowered into his grave, only Michael and a few others suspected his death had not been accidental. Not far away, on a slight incline at the rear of the cemetery, 2 men sat in a car and watched the crowd with binoculars. Chapter 17. By noon Saturday, the nurses and doctors had concocted a perfect plan to get rid of Gunther. It was brilliant. Just transfer his sister and he would have no reason to stay. On Friday, Lacey had asked the doctor when she might be stable enough to make the trip back to Tallahassee. There were plenty of hospitals there, and fine ones, and since she was simply recuperating and not awaiting surgery, why couldn't she return to her hometown? Not long after that conversation, a nurse made a noisy entrance into Lacey's room, waking from a nap not only the patient but her brother as well, and the situation unraveled quickly. Gunther, using strong language, demanded that the nurses and orderlies show some respect for privacy and simple human decency and stop barging in at all hours of the day. A second nurse came to the rescue of the first, but succeeded only in doubling the level of abuse. The plot was hatched to get Gunther out of the hospital. At about the time Hugo was being buried, Lacey left the hospital in Panama City in an ambulance for the 2-hour drive to Tallahassee. Gunther left too, but not before leveling a few parting shots at the staff. He followed his sister in his Mercedes-Benz S600 sedan, pitch black in color and gobbling up $3,100 a month on a 4-year lease. Evidently, the folks in Panama City had called ahead and warned the folks in Tallahassee. As Lacey's gurney was being wheeled onto the elevator for the ride to a private room on the 4th floor, 2 large security guards joined her and glared at Gunther, who glared right back. "Let it go," Lacey hissed at her brother. The new room was larger than the last one, and Gunther had a fine time rearranging the furniture into another cozy workspace. After the doctors and nurses checked in, Gunther looked at his sister and announced,
"We're going for a walk. I can tell already these doctors are far better than the other ones, and they say it's important to move around. You're probably getting bed sores. Your legs are fine, so let's go."
He gently wrestled her out of bed, put her feet into a pair of cheap cotton hospital slippers, and said,
"Grab my elbow."
They eased out of the room and into a wide hallway. He nodded to a large window at the far end and said,
"We're walking all the way down there and back. Okay?"
"Okay, but I'm very sore. Everything aches."
"I know. Take your time, and if you feel faint, just say so."
"Got it."
They shuffled along, ignoring the casual glances from the nurses, clutching each other as Lacey's feet and legs began to work. Her left knee was severely bruised and cut and painful to move. She gritted her teeth, determined to impress her brother. His grip was strong and comforting. He was not taking no for an answer. They touched the window and turned around. Her room seemed a mile away, and by the time they approached it, her left knee was screaming. He helped her into bed and said,
"Okay, we're doing that once an hour until bedtime. Got it?"
"If you can do it, I can do it."
"Atta girl."
He tucked in the sheets around her and sat on the edge of her bed. He patted her arm and said,
"Your face is looking better by the hour."
"My face looks like hamburger meat."
"Okay, but sirloin, maybe? Grade A, organic, and pasture-fed." "Look, Lacey, we're going to talk and talk until you cannot talk anymore. Yesterday I spent some time with Michael. Good guy, and he filled me in. I don't know everything about the investigation, and I shouldn't, but I know enough. I know you and Hugo went to the reservation Monday night to meet an informant. It was a trap, a setup, a situation too dangerous to walk into. Once they lured you there, they had you dead to rights and on their property. The wreck was no accident. You were deliberately rammed head-on by a guy driving a stolen truck, and immediately after the collision, he, or someone with him, went through your car and took both cell phones and your iPad. Then these assholes disappeared into the night and will probably never be found. Are you with me?"
"I think so."
"So here's what we're going to do. We're going to start with you and Hugo driving to the reservation. Time, route, what was on the radio, what did you talk about, everything. Same thing while you were sitting in your car waiting at the casino. Time, conversation, radio, emails, everything. And we're going to drive your car down the road to meet the informant. I'll do the questions, hundreds of them, and you come up with the answers. And after I grill you for 30 minutes, we'll take a time out and you can nap if you want. Then we're walking to the end of the hallway again, Sound like fun?
No.
Sorry, kid. You have no choice. We've got the legs working. Now it's time for the brain. Okay? First question. What time did you leave Tallahassee Monday evening?
She closed her eyes and licked her swollen lips. It was early evening, but not dark. I guess around 7:30 or so.
Was there a reason you waited so late?
She thought for a second, then began nodding with a smile.
Yes, the guy worked until 9, a later shift in the casino.
Perfect. What were you wearing?
She opened her eyes.
Seriously?
Dead serious, Lacey. Think hard and answer my questions. This is not a game.
Jeans, I think, and a light shirt. It was hot and we were casual.
What route did you take?
Interstate 10, same as always. There's only one way to get there. Exit onto State 288, go south for 10 miles, turn left onto the tollway.
Did you guys listen to the radio?
It's always on, but almost muted. I think Hugo was sleeping.
She groaned and immediately started crying. Her swollen lips quivered and tears ran down her cheeks. He wiped them for her with a tissue, but said nothing.
His funeral was today, right?
She asked.
Yes.
I wish I could have gone.
Why? Hugo wouldn't know if you showed up or not. Funerals are such a waste of time. Nothing but a show for the living. The dead don't care. The trend now is not to have a funeral, but a celebration. To celebrate what? The dead guy damn sure ain't celebrating.
Sorry I brought it up.
Back to Monday night.
Word spread that Lacey was back in town, and by early evening, visitors were bumping into one another. Since most were acquaintances, the mood grew festive and the nurses complained more than once. Gunther, always the flirt, took center stage, did most of the talking, hogged the attention, and fought with the nurses. Lacey was exhausted and content to let him do whatever. At first, she was horrified at the thought of seeing anyone, or rather, letting anyone see her. With her slick head, stitches, bruises, and puffy eyes and cheeks, she felt like an extra in a cheap monster flick. But Gunther put things in perspective with,
"Chill. These people love you, and they know you just survived a head-on collision. And in a month, you'll be hot again, and most of these poor folks will still be homely. We got the genes, baby."
Visitation was over at 9 p.m., and the nurses happily cleared out Lacey's room. She was exhausted. Her afternoon torture session with Gunther had lasted for 4 hours, and ended only with the arrival of friends. 4 hours of constant grilling and long hikes down the hall, and he was promising more tomorrow. He closed the door, said he wished he could lock it and keep everyone out, then turned off the lights and made his nest on the sofa. With the aid of a mild sedative, Lacey soon fell into a deep sleep. The scream, the sound of terror from a voice that never screamed, never showed emotion. Something was wrong with the seatbelt. He was complaining. She glanced over, then the scream as his wide shoulders instinctively threw back. The lights, so bright, so close, so shockingly unavoidable. The impact, the sense of her body hurling forward for a split second before being caught and slammed backward. The noise, the explosion of a bomb in her lap as 5 tons of steel, metal, glass, aluminum, and rubber collided and tangled. The vicious blow to her face as the airbag a foot away detonated and shot forward at 200 miles per hour, saving her life but doing its share of damage. The spinning, her car airborne for a second as it turned 180 degrees, slinging debris. Then, nothing. How many times had she heard victims say, "I must have been out of it for a few seconds"? No one ever knows how long. But there was movement. Hugo, stuck in the windshield, was moving his legs, trying to either get out or get back in. Hugo moaning. And to her left, a shadow, a figure, a man with a light crouching and looking at her. Did she see his face? No. And if she did, she could not remember it. And then he was on the passenger's side, near Hugo. Or was it another one? Were there two shadows moving around her car? Hugo was moaning. Her head was bleeding, pounding. Footsteps crunched on broken glass. The lights of a vehicle swept the wreckage and disappeared. Darkness. Blackness. There were two of them, Gunther. Two of them.
Okay, sis, you're dreaming now, and you're sweating. You've been mumbling and shaking for half an hour. Let's wake up and talk, okay?
There were two of them.
I hear you. Wake up now and look at me. It's okay, sis. Just another bad dream.
He turned on a small lamp on the table. What time is it? She asked.
What difference does it make? You're not catching a plane. It's 2:30 in the morning, and you've had quite a dream.
What did I say?
Nothing intelligible. Lots of mumbling and groaning. You want some water?
She took a sip from a straw and pushed a button to raise her bed. It's coming back, she said. I'm seeing things now. I can remember some of it.
Atta girl. Now, these two figures you saw. Let's talk about them. One was obviously the driver of the truck. The other was probably driving the getaway vehicle. What did you see?
I don't know. Not much. Both were men, I think. I'm pretty sure of that.
Okay. Can you see their faces?
No. Nothing. I'd just been hit, you know? Nothing is clear now.
Sure. Where did you keep your cell phone?
On the console, usually. I can't say for sure where it was at that moment, but probably on the console.
And where did Hugo keep his?
Always in his right rear pocket, unless he was wearing a jacket.
And he wasn't wearing one, right?
Right. As I said, it was hot and we were casual.
So someone had to reach inside the car to get the cell phones. Can you see that as it happened? Anyone touch you or Hugo?
She closed her eyes and shook her head. No, I don't remember that. The door opened slowly and a nurse entered the room. She said, "Everything okay? Your pulse spiked." Gunther said,
"She's dreaming. Everything's fine."
The nurse ignored him and touched Lacey's arm. "How do you feel, Lacey?" "I'm good," she said, her eyes still closed. "You need to sleep, okay?" To which Gunther responded,
"Well, it's kind of hard to sleep with you guys in here every other hour."
"There's a motel across the street if you'd like it better over there," the nurse responded coolly. Gunther let it pass, and the nurse left. Chapter 18. When Lyman Grid arrived at the police station at 5 on Sunday afternoon, he had a suspicion that something unpleasant was underway. The chief had never requested a meeting at such a time, and he'd been vague about its purpose. He was waiting outside the station along with his son Billy Kappel, when Lyman parked his truck. Billy was one of the 10-member tribal council and had become a dominant force in the government. As they were exchanging greetings, the chairman of the council, Adam Horn, arrived on his motorcycle. There weren't many smiles, and as they entered the building, Lyman was even more suspicious. The chief had been calling daily since the accident, and he was obviously not pleased with Grit's work. As an appointee, the constable served at the pleasure of the chief, and the two had never been close. In fact, Lyman distrusted the chief, as well as his son and Mr. Horn, who was generally held in low regard by most Tapakola. Elias Kappel had been the chief for 6 years and was firmly in control of the tribe. If Billy was his right-hand man, then Horn was the left. The three had effectively outmaneuvered their political enemies and seemed intractable. They smothered dissension and ruled with a tight grip. And no one really objected as long as the casino was full and the dividend checks were flowing. They gathered in Grit's office, and he took his spot behind his desk. As he faced the three of them, his chair suddenly felt like a hot seat. The chief, a man of few words and limited social skills, began with, "We want to talk about the investigation into what happened Monday night." Horn added, "There seem to be some unanswered questions." Lyman nodded along. "Sure," he said. "What would you like to know?" "Everything," the chief said. Lyman opened a file, fiddled with some papers, and pulled out a report. He went through the basics of the accident. The vehicles involved, the injuries, the rescue, the death of Mr. Hatch. The file was already 2 inches thick with reports and photos. The video from the police in Foley, however, was not in the file and not referenced. Grit smelled trouble with the chief and was maintaining two files, the official one on his desk and a secret one outside his office. Because Frog's video had been handed over to the sheriff, there was an even chance that the chief might be aware of it. Wisely, Grit placed it in the official file but kept a copy at home. "What were they doing here, on our land?" the chief asked. And his tone left no doubt this was his most important question. "That I don't know yet. I'm supposed to meet with Mr. Michael Geismar tomorrow and learn more. He's their boss. I've asked that question, but so far the answers have been vague."
"These people investigate judges, right?"
Horn asked.
"That's correct. They are not law enforcement, just investigators with law degrees."
"Then what the hell were they doing here?" the chief demanded.
"They have no jurisdiction on our land. They were here on business, I presume, at midnight on a Monday night." "I'm digging, chief. I'm digging, okay? There are a lot of questions and we're chasing leads."
"Have you talked to the girl who was driving the car?"
"No, I tried to, but her doctors said no. They moved her to Tallahassee yesterday, and I'll go there in a day or two and see what she has to say."
Billy said,
"You should have already talked to her."
Lyman bristled but kept his cool.
"As I said, her doctors would not allow it."
Tension was rising by the minute, and it was becoming clearer, at least to Lyman, that the meeting would probably not end well.
"Have you talked to outsiders?"
Horn asked.
"Of course. It's part of the investigation."
"Who?"
"Well, let's see. I've had several conversations with a Mr. Geismar. I've asked him twice what they were doing here, and he was vague. I've spoken with her doctors. Got nowhere. Both insurance companies have sent adjusters here to check on the vehicles, and I talked to them, and so on. I can't remember everyone I've talked to. Part of my job is dealing with outsiders."
Do you know any more about the stolen truck? The chief asked.
Nothing new, Grit said, then repeated the basics without mentioning the video from Foley.
And no idea who was driving it? The chief asked.
Not until this morning.
The three seemed to stiffen.
Go on, the chief grunted. Sheriff Pickett stopped by late Friday for a coffee. You know Frog Freeman's store north of Sterling? Well, Frog was open late on Monday. Not really open, but then not closed either, and a customer came in looking for ice. Frog's been robbed, so he's got cameras. Wanna see?
The three nodded grimly. Lyman tapped some keys on his desktop and turned it around. The video appeared. The truck was parked in front of the store, the driver got out, the passenger held a bloody cloth to his nose, the driver disappeared into the store and returned a short time later. They drove off.
And what does this prove? The chief asked.
Nothing, but it's somewhat suspicious. Given the time and location and the fact that there's virtually no one on the road at that hour.
Horn asked,
So if you stretch things, we're supposed to believe that the guy with the busted nose was driving the stolen truck that caused the accident?
Lyman shrugged and said,
I'm not stretching anything. I didn't make the video. I'm just showing it to you.
Have you traced the license plates?
The chief asked.
Yes. Fake Florida tags. No such number in the records. Why would anyone bother with fake tags if they were not up to something bad? If you ask me, the fake tags point the finger directly at these two. The passenger got his face smacked with the airbag and it drew blood. They weren't smart enough to have some ice in the follow-up vehicle, the one with the fake tags, and driven, of course, by the other guy in the video. So they make their escape and just happen to see Frog's store open late. They're trying to get away, not thinking too clearly, and probably not that smart to begin with, so they don't think about security cameras. Big mistake. They get their pictures taken. And it's just a matter of time before we find him.
The chief said,
Well, Lyman, that's not going to happen, at least not now, and not by you. I'm terminating you as of right now.
Lyman absorbed this shot to the gut with more composure than he knew he had. He stared at the three of them, all sitting over there with their arms folded across their thick bellies, and finally asked,
On what grounds?
The chief offered a phony smile and said,
I don't have to give a reason. It's called termination at will, and it's clearly set out in our bylaws. As the chief, I have the power to hire and fire all department heads. You know that.
Indeed, I do.
Lyman stared at the three of them. Realized it was over, and decided to have some fun. He said,
So the big boys want the investigation quashed, right? This video will never see the light of day, and all the mysteries surrounding this car wreck will never be solved. A man gets killed, and the killers walk away. That sound about right, Chief?
I'm asking you to leave right now. The chief growled.
This is my office, and I have my stuff here.
It is no longer your office. Find a box and get it out of here. We'll wait.
You're kidding.
Dead serious. And hurry up, okay? It is Sunday afternoon.
I didn't call this meeting.
Shut up, Lyman, and start packing. Hand over your keys and your guns. Don't touch those files. Pack up your crap and let's move. And Lyman, it goes without saying that it's in your best interest to keep your mouth shut.
Of course. That's what we do around here, right?
bury our heads, keep our mouths shut, and cover up for the big boys.
You got it. And the part about shutting your mouth can begin right now, the chief said.
Lyman began opening drawers. Michael tapped on Lacey's door with some trepidation, and as he opened it, his worst fears were confirmed. Gunther was still there. He was sitting on the edge of her bed, a small backgammon board between them. He reluctantly folded it and placed it on the sofa in his office. Michael and Lacey chatted for a few minutes. Then Michael delicately inquired,
"Could we have a few moments in private?"
"For what?" Gunther demanded.
"Some sensitive matters." "If it's about her job, I think the conversation can wait until tomorrow. It is, after all, Sunday evening, and she's in no condition to deal with issues related to work. If it's about the car wreck and the investigation and all that crap, then I'm not leaving the room. Lacey needs a second set of ears, and she needs my advice."
Lacey did not intervene. Michael raised his hands, surrendered, and said,
"Okay, I'll not discuss the office."
He eased into a chair beside her bed and looked at the side of her face. The swelling was almost gone and the bruises were changing colors. Gunther asked,
"Have you had dinner? The cafeteria has some frozen sandwiches that were made at least 2 years ago and taste like roofing shingles. They're hard to recommend, but I've eaten three and I'm still alive."
"Gee, I'll pass.
Some coffee, perhaps? It's bad, but drinkable,"
Michael said.
"A great idea, thanks."
Anything to get him out of the room. Gunther found his shoes and took off. Michael wasted no time.
"I stopped by Verna's this afternoon, and as you can expect, it's still a gloomy place.
I've emailed twice but got nothing. I've called twice and talked to whoever was answering her cell. I need to see her."
"Well, that's what I want to talk about, and I'll shut up the moment he walks in the door. I'd rather keep this between us." Verna is still sleepwalking through this nightmare, as anyone would be, and she's still in shock. But she's coming around, and I'm not sure I like what I'm hearing. There is a group of Hugo's friends, including a couple of pals from law school, and they are full of advice. They have big ideas about lawsuits, with the big target being the Tapacola. That's where the gold mine is located, and they're dreaming of ways to get it. Frankly, and I'm no tort lawyer, I can't connect the liability. Just because the accident happened on the reservation doesn't mean the Indians are at fault. The accident is also subject to tribal law, which is not your average brand of tort law. Because he was a state employee, Verna will get half his salary for the rest of her life. As we know, that's not much. Hugo had a private life policy for $100,000, and it will be easy to collect. Next is the auto policy on the stolen truck. According to the guy who appears to be the main spokesman, and he's a real windbag, the truck was covered by Southern Mutual and had a liability limit of $250,000. Even though it was stolen, it was still covered. It might take a lawsuit, but he seems to like their chances. I'm not so sure. Now things might get complicated. There was a lot of talk about suing Toyota for the defective seat belt and airbag. That would necessarily involve you and your insurance company. And that's what I didn't like about their tone.
You're kidding, Michael. Verna is blaming me.
Right now, Verna is blaming everyone. She's broken, she's terrified, and she's not rational. And I'm not sure she's getting good advice. I got the impression these guys are sitting around the table, her table, scheming ways to sue anyone who's remotely connected to Hugo's death. Your name got kicked around, and I heard no objection from Verna.
They discussed this in front of you?
Oh, they don't care.
The house is packed with people. Food is still arriving. Aunts, uncles, cousins, anybody with an opinion can grab a cupcake and pull up a chair. I left with a bad feeling.
I don't believe this, Michael. Verna and I have been close for years.
It will take time, Lacey. Time for you to heal, time for her to heal. Verna is a good person, and when she gets over the shock, she'll come around. For now, though, I'd cool it.
I don't believe this,
she mumbled again. Gunther barged in with a tray and three cups of steaming coffee. This stuff even smells bad, he said. He passed out the coffee and excused himself while he stepped into the bathroom. Michael leaned over and whispered, When is he leaving?
Tomorrow, I promise.
Not a moment too soon.
Chapter 19 Anne Stultz arrived late Monday morning to spend a day or two with her daughter. Fortunately, her son was not in the room, though it was apparent he had not yet closed down his office and moved out. Lacey explained that Gunther was running errands. The good news was that he would be leaving around noon, because, of course, Atlanta was collapsing in his absence and the city had to be saved. The even better news was that her doctor planned to release her on the following day. She had convinced him her hair would grow just as fast at home. A nurse removed stitches as Anne prattled on about the gossip down in Clearwater. A physical therapist arrived for half an hour of stretching, and he gave Lacey a chart of exercises to work on every day at home. When Gunther returned, he had a sack full of deli sandwiches, and the urgent news that he must get home. After an hour with his mother, he couldn't wait to leave the hospital. After 4 days with him, Lacey needed a break. He was wiping tears as he said goodbye. He begged Lacey to call him for anything, especially if slime balls like insurance adjusters and ambulance-chasing lawyers came slithering around. He knew exactly how to handle such people. On the way out, he gave his mother a perfunctory peck on the cheek, and he was gone. Lacey closed her eyes and enjoyed the silence for a long time. The following day, Tuesday, an orderly rolled her out of the hospital and helped her into Anne's car. She was perfectly capable of making the walk herself, but the hospital had its rules. 15 minutes later, Anne parked in the lot beside Lacey's building. Lacey looked at it and said,
Only 8 days ago, but it seems like a month.
Anne said,
I'll get the crutches.
I don't need crutches, Mom, and I'm not using them.
But the physical therapist said,
Please, he's not here and I know what I can do.
She walked without a limp into her apartment. Simon, her British neighbor, was waiting. He had been caring for Frankie, the Frenchie, and when Lacey saw her dog, she slowly bent to her knees and grabbed him.
How do I look?
Lacey asked Simon.
Well, pretty good, I'd say, in spite of it all. I suppose things could be worse.
You should have seen me a week ago.
It's good seeing you now, Lacey. We've been quite worried.
Let's have some tea.
It was exhilarating to be out of the hospital, and Lacey chattered away as Simon and Anne listened and laughed. The conversation stayed clear of Hugo and the accident. There would be enough of that later. Lacey hit her stride telling Gunther stories, all of which seemed even funnier now that he was gone. Anne kept saying,
His father raised him, not me.
Throughout the afternoon, Lacey called friends, napped off and on, stretched and exercised precisely as told, laid off the painkillers, nibbled on nuts and fruit bars, and looked at a few of her work files. At 4 p.m., Michael arrived for a meeting and Anne went to the nearest mall.
Claiming to have a stiff back, Michael said he needed to stay on his feet. So he paced, back and forth along the wide front window of her apartment, walking and talking, a man troubled by his thoughts.
"Are you sure you don't want to take a leave of absence?" he asked. "We can cover your salary for 30 days.
"And what would I do for 30 days around here, Michael? Pull my hair out just as it starts sprouting?"
"You need the rest. The doctor has said so."
"Forget it," she said bluntly. "I'm not calling time out. I'll be at the office next week, scars and all."
"That's what I figured. Have you talked to Verna?"
"No. You discouraged it, remember?"
"Right. Nothing has changed since Sunday. She's out of money, of course, no surprise there, and eager to collect the life insurance."
"You know his salary, Michael. They were living week to week. Can we help in some way?"
"I don't think so. None of us are exactly overpaid. Plus, it's a big family. She'll survive until the checks arrive. Long term, though, it's going to be rough with 4 kids and half a salary."
"Unless the lawsuits work."
"A big unknown."
He stopped for a sip of water. She was reclining on the sofa, exhausted after her first few hours of freedom. He said,
"We have 2 weeks, Lacey. 2 weeks to either serve the complaint on McDover or let it lapse. Do you still want the case, or should I give it to Justin?"
"It's mine, Michael. All mine, especially now."
"Why am I not surprised? Frankly, I don't think Justin is quite ready for it. Nor does he want it. Can't blame him for that."
"I'm keeping it."
"Fine. Then do you have a plan?" "As it now stands, the complaint, signed by our pal Greg Myers, who is in hiding and had better remain so, alleges bribery in the form of the ownership of 4 condos in Rabbit Run, properties given to McDover by developers in return for favorable rulings. The complaint has very few specifics and no evidence. It gives the names of the foreign companies that are the official owners, but we have no way of proving that she is involved in the background. We can walk in with subpoenas and take her files and records and such, but I seriously doubt we'll learn much. If the criminal activity is as sophisticated as Myers says it is, then I find it difficult to believe McDover would leave any of her dirty records where they might be found. So it's probably best to save the subpoenas for later. McDover will lawyer up and bring in more legal talent than I care to think about. It will become a slugfest, where every move we make is hotly contested by the other side. And, in the end, there's an excellent chance McDover can prove that she purchased the condos as investments. Something not unheard of in Florida."
"You don't sound too enthused, Michael."
"I'm never enthused by one of our cases, but we really have no choice. By now, both of us believe Myers. We believe what's in the complaint, and we believe his other stories of wholesale corruption. Money laundering, bribery, not to mention murder."
"Well, now that you mentioned murder, let's talk about it. There was a gang involved, Michael. First, the informant who lured us to a spot deep inside the reservation, then vanished in mid-sentence. Second, the guy driving the truck. Third, his partner, who joined him at the scene, took our cell phones, then gave him a ride in the getaway car. Add the guy who stole the truck. Somebody tampered with the seat belts and airbags in my car. So if you have that many foot soldiers, there must be a brain or two calling the shots. That adds up to a gang. If we assume it's Dubose, and I'm at a loss to give you the name of another suspect, then it sounds like the type of violence that's right down his alley. Hugo was murdered, Michael, and we can't solve it. I doubt seriously if the Tapacola can either."
"Are you suggesting the FBI?"
You and I both know that's where it's going, eventually. The question is when. If we invite them to the party now, then we run the risk.